This week, I'm editing whilst walking the Camino del Norte in Asturias, hence the wistful sounds of cowbells and bird singing. So, let's get on with it! Hello everyone, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. This week, the EdTech Podcast is brought to you by Classlist, the world's first virtual school gate, and thought-leading EdTech summit, EdTechX Europe. First up, Classlist. Classlist is the world's first virtual school gate, an online platform for parents to communicate and lend trusted support to each other. With over 70 UK schools signed up in 3 months, Classlist is now crowdfunding on Crowdcube. Go to the Crowdcube website today and invest whilst there's still time. 80% of their target is already achieved. All investors of whatever scale are very welcome. Bear in mind that any investment you do make of your capital is at your own risk. You can also find more about Classlist at schoolclasslist.com. Now on to this bumper episode where I get to know Hackney-based EdTech Startup Accelerator Programme, Emerge Education. First off, I run into the EdSpace and Emerge community teams in a cafe having lunch. Next, venture hunter Lucy Lynn Evans explains what's in it for EdTech companies joining Emerge and reveals new investment from both Oxford University Press and China's largest EdTech company into the programme. Finally, I catch up with some of the fifth cohort of Emerge Education startups following their nail-biting finale to 12 intense weeks where they pitch to investors. This week's startups featured are medical training company Open Simulation and parental engagement platform Easy Peasy, with more to follow next week. So I've just finished my interview with Ian Ashman at Hackney Community College, and I thought I'd pop into a little cafe on Oxon Road for some lunch, and randomly heard some people talking about a podcast and how they love podcasts, aren't podcasts great? So I thought I'd introduce myself, and it turns out that, lo and behold, sat at table 9 were the group from EdSpace and Emerge Education, which are tenants within Hackney Community College. So, rather rudely, as they're having their lunch, I thought I'd just give them the opportunity to introduce themselves as we've been sat having a chat and talk about what they've been doing in EdTech in Hackney. So, here goes.
My name is Chrissy Lamb. I am working with accounts and budgeting and working with forecasting.
And how was your lunch?
Lunch was incredible. Mushroom soup was very good.
Excellent, excellent. So I'm going to move along. So what was your name again?
My name's Iona, and I'm from Emerge Education.
And Iona, what do you do within Emerge Education?
I am operations manager for the programme, so I help to manage the series of events and workshops for the accelerator.
How about you there, fine sir?
Hi, I'm James, and I work at EdSpace.
And what do you do at EdSpace?
So I'm the operations manager, and that sort of involves trying to make EdSpace the best that it can be, so lots of people want to come and use us.
Fantastic. And how about education technology in Hackney? How do you think that's progressing, and what do you think the opportunities are in the borough?
I think it's a really exciting place to be. At EdSpace, we've got so many different EdTech startups, and I think it's really becoming sort of the hub for EdTech in the UK.
Brilliant. And what would you give your soup out of 10?
I'd give it 8. It could have been a bit warmer, but it was really hearty.
Excellent. Everyone loves a hearty soup, don't they? And just finally, let's move on. Would you like to say your name and what you do as well?
Hi, I'm Laura Billings, and I run EdSpace.
Excellent. And we've been talking on the podcast about the opportunity for EdTech within Hackney and what that means for both educators and learners. What would your summarisation of that be?
I think, for one, it's exciting that EdSpace is based in Hackney. Hackney's where I live as well, so I have a close connection. EdSpace is one of the only shared workspaces that is specific to education. So we think it's really important that we're here and that we're growing. The connection with the college is great. Ian, the principal, is fantastic, very entrepreneurial, likes the fact that by having us here and all of the companies that work with us on campus, we can start to bring closer together some of the students and teachers, the tech guys, the developers, the entrepreneurs, and if we're co-located, we've got more of an opportunity to build and grow things together.
Perfect. Well, guys, I won't interrupt your lunch anymore. Thank you very much, and catch up next time.
So my name is Lucy Lynn Evans, and I am the Venture Hunter, which is the...
Cool job title.
Yeah, interesting job title, which means that I source the startups for the accelerator and other investment vehicles that we have.
Amazing. And so Emerge Education is an EdTech accelerator program.
Correct. So we find entrepreneurs from all around the world that are innovating in education using technology. And we take the most promising founders and products. We bring them to the UK and we lay the foundations for a globally successful ed tech business is the idea. And we do that by introducing them to investors and they receive £40,000 investment at the beginning of a 3-month program. Then we pass them through this program. And the main aims of that are to introduce them to the people and organizations that will help them grow. In 3 broad categories, that means market access, because this is particularly difficult in education, accessing schools, even if it's enterprise or lifelong learners, figuring out how to do that and who they should be talking to. It's also access to expertise. It's really important to speak to people who have already trodden that path, and so we link them up to what we call venture partners. And this is a model that's fairly unique to Emerge Education. These are mentors, usually edtech entrepreneurs who have grown successful edtech businesses and exited, say. And they also invest a small amount of money in 1 or 2 of the companies that they think they would be particularly useful to. So the venture partners choose 1 or 2 companies that they would be particularly useful to, and they invest a small amount of money and receive some equity. And that means that when they're working with them on a weekly basis through the course of the 3-month program, their incentives are aligned with the company and they really want to help them grow. And so it's moving away from a spray and pray mentoring approach and being really specific with the type of help that each startup gets. And the third category, along with market access and access to expertise, is access to capital. And we have 50 angel investors that have already invested in the Emerge cohorts and also a wider network of 100 individuals and moving into strategic investors as well.
Wonderful. Okay. And in terms of the first chapter of the podcast looking at Hackney, how does Emerge Education make the most of either schools or colleges or students on your doorstep as well, and that you're based here in Hackney Community College?
Okay, so we are currently in EdSpace, which is an education co-working space. The types of companies we have in here range from after-school charities to fledgling school chains to fast-growing tech companies. And it wouldn't be possible without Hackney Community College that have rented this property to us at a low cost. And they do that because they want access to the innovations that are coming out of here. And we work with them by running beta testing with the students.
I suppose one thing that's very important in terms of the success of edtech startups is if that product or solution or service is going to be used by educators at the end, then it needs very much to be tested by educators as well. So in terms of that expertise that you mentioned previously, do you have any educators or academies helping to assist with the product development that's happening here as well?
Yeah, so that is crucial. We have 2 types of companies that come to us broadly. Sometimes they are really commercially savvy and they have a great business head and they've got a decent product. Sometimes that they've put the pedagogy first and foremost and in fact they need help on the commercial side. For the former, and for both, it's really important that they talk to the people that will be actually using the product. And so we work with a network of school chains, ARC and Oasis Academies, for example, and they will trial the products, give feedback along the course of the program, and then potentially are the first customers for those products.
Okay, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yesterday, because that was a very exciting day for Emerge Education, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was our 5th demo day. We have now supported 35 companies, and yesterday was definitely the most impressive event that we've put on, both in terms of the quality of the startups, both when they came to us and the speed, the progress they've made during the program, and also the event itself. We've now learned lessons about how to deliver a tidy event to investors where it means that actual meaningful interactions will happen afterwards.
And you had the cocktail party, so everyone is very quiet in the office here today.
Yes, and my voice is a little husky.
Brilliant. Well, I won't speak too loudly. Okay, and then just finally, what's next for Emerge Education? Obviously, I think yesterday you launched some quite big news and I think there's big ambition, so could you tell us a little bit about those as well, please?
Sure thing. Yesterday we announced that we have investment from Oxford University Press and also from Qtone, which is one of China's largest education technology companies. And it puts us in a great place where we feel like a real step change has happened. So at the moment we run one acceleration program from London, and now that will begin to change both vertically in terms of the types of investments we make and also horizontally perhaps as we internationalize. And so we're beginning to make our own investments of the same kind of size of 40, 50K, and that may change over the coming years. And horizontally, for example, for the next month, we are going to do a roadshow around Asia, and we'll be meeting startups and investors to kind of assess appetite for ed tech there and potentially move into those markets.
Okay, so consider this. You can have one marshmallow now, or if you can hang on for 5 minutes, you can have two. So this was a real experiment run by the renowned psychologist Walter Mischel. He tracked children aged 3 and 4 years old and found that those who were able to resist this particular temptation went on to have higher grades in high school, bigger salaries at work, even longer and more sustained relationships at home. There's something crucial that's already developed in the first few years of life that sets this trajectory for our future. But something is not right, because by the time children arrive at school, half of them are not ready to learn because they lack these basic skills: concentration, self-control, getting on well with peers, being able to bounce back from mistakes. Now, this leads to major inequalities for kids later in life in health, wealth, and well-being.
Hi, I'm Jen Lexmond. I'm the founder and CEO of Easy Peasy.
Jen, I was at the Emerge Education Demo Day yesterday and I thoroughly enjoyed your presentation. For everyone listening, could you give a review of Easy Peasy?
Absolutely. So Easy Peasy is the coaching app for parents. What we're doing is supporting parents during their children's early years with the intention of getting kids ready to learn when they get to school. So the situation today in the UK, but also in the States and many parts of the world, is that by the time children arrive at school age 5, around half of them are not ready to start learning in the classroom environment. They're struggling to concentrate, focus their attention, to get on well with others, to be able to bounce back from mistakes quickly and regulate and manage emotions and responses. A lot of these types of skills are developed at home through positive parent-child interactions, through play, through a home learning environment that's well-oriented and stimulating. And for many reasons, it's hard to provide that all the time. Parents are tired, time poor, you run out of ideas of things to do. We've done loads of research with parents in the design of Easy Peasy. We know all parents want the best for their kids, and they do everything they can. What they need is a helpful prompt, an ear to listen to them, offer some advice. And what Easy Peasy does is a digital outreach service for parents. It gives them everything they need, all the tools they need to support their kids' early development. We prompt parents with fun, simple game ideas straight to their phone, really engaging content, no preparation, no cost involved, just simple ideas that you can do with your kids wherever you are.
And are the ideas evidence-based in terms of outcomes that they might have? I mean, obviously, there's an argument just to play because playing's fun and I like playing and I like that argument, but efficacy is a big thing. What's the kind of thinking behind the content that you put on the app?
Yeah, I mean, that's really important to us at Easy Peasy. My background is in social research and, you know, we're working with, we have a partnership with Oxford University. All of our content, first of all, is aligned to the National Early Years Curriculum. It's a long and complicated acronym, EYFSP, Early Years Foundation Stage.
What's the P?
Well, that's the profile element, which is like the form of assessment.
Right.
The first four letters there are just the curriculum that guides all the learning that happens in nursery and reception year. So okay. we align all of our content to that. We work with experts in education and development psychology to assess all of those creative game ideas to ensure that they're genuinely building those skills. And then with Oxford, we work with them to actually run efficacy trials or randomized control trials where we really look at, okay, here's a group of parents using Easy Peasy and here's another group of similar parents not using Easy Peasy. Can we really detect a positive influence from Easy Peasy over and above all of the other things going on in those families' lives? And that kind of evidence is what I think should be underpinning all of our educational programs. As you said, play is great. We want to keep that at the core, but it needs to be purposeful. It needs to be genuinely improving kids' outcomes for me.
Actually, I was wondering, so when I thought about your partnership with Oxford University, I was at an event recently and people were talking about the Crawford Report. I think the main aspects of that are that all other variables being the same, those that don't go to private school suffer in terms of future earnings and grades at university, or entry to university even, due to what they deemed the defining aspects being networking and confidence and the ability to go out and connect with networks, and that going right back to the beginning. So I suppose in terms of this and Oxford, what I wondered was, is it kind of like a nice mechanism to improve their entries from a wide variety of backgrounds? Possibly not, but that was my thought process behind the two.
I think, okay, if I understand what you're getting at, is something about could Easy Peasy support social mobility?
Yes.
And that's our mission, really. You know, when I introduce Easy Peasy, I often talk about the marshmallow experiment, which was a very famous psychological experiment run in the 1970s. A psychologist called Walter Mischel took young children aged 3 and 4. He said, you can have a marshmallow now, or if you can wait for 5 minutes, you can have 2. And I want it
right now.
yeah. And many of the children did. But he did find this really striking association. Those children who were able to delay their gratification, which is the psychological term, they did go on to have better outcomes in not just in education, but in future earnings and also aspects of relationship stability. And there's something magic and crucial happening at the very beginning that sets a trajectory for our futures. And the other thing is that for governments and for investors, we know that investing in the early years is much, you get a much higher return from investing in those first 5 years than you do. I think it's like £8 for every £1 invested, if you look at it from a financial point of view. But for what we're talking about, we can do a small intervention in the early years and find that it has a massive difference later down the line. Whereas to try to intervene once a child is a teenager or a young adult, it can be done, absolutely. Mm. It is more expensive and it is harder.
That's interesting. I was talking to the founder of Doodle Maths yesterday about, I think it's Sir Adrian Smith's proposal or consideration to extend mathematics learning as an obligatory thing until 18. And we were talking about, you know, actually the necessity, as you just described, to actually sort of get in early. So although that can have a benefit, etc., but actually trying to enhance learning at that very early stage as being quite crucial. What's the business model behind Easy Peasy?
Yeah, so Easy Peasy is absolutely free for parents. And that was a really important part of our model so that no parent is excluded from receiving Easy Peasy. And to do that, we have built an offer for schools and nurseries, children's centers, and other types of early years settings. We offer annual subscriptions of Easy Peasy based on the number of families that the school is working with. And this allows them to share Easy Peasy with families at their school free of charge. for the school, what we're providing, or for the nursery, what we're providing to them is important analytics and data about parent engagement. So all of these earlier settings are regulated by Ofsted, the UK regulatory body for education. And one of the growing priorities in Ofsted is parent engagement. So there's a growing recognition of the importance that parents play in children's early learning and development right through school. And there's an increasing onus on schools to show how they're doing that. How are they reaching out? So we offer data to them to show how parents are using our app, what they're getting out of it, how it's improving relationships with kids, and they can use that as evidence for their reporting.
And have you worked with local nurseries and sort of primary schools here?
Yeah, we just launched a pilot trial that we're doing with Oxford all the way across Newham. So we have a partnership agreement with the London Borough of Newham, so where the Olympics were, and it's actually an incredibly diverse borough with, I think they have over 200 different languages spoken in the borough by their families.
AT in Hackney seem like very small.
Right, I hope I'm getting that right, but it's a very diverse place, bordering with Hackney, obviously. So there's some similarities, and so we're now in 16 different children's centres that have, there's a primary schools attached to them, and early years has a strange fragmented system. So there's children's centres, nursery schools, nurseries, etc.
Childminders and
Childminders is another group that we haven't started working with childminders yet, but we're really keen to, because they're also regulated by Ofsted in the same way that a fully fledged school is. But they're often, childminders often are parents, usually mothers, sometimes fathers, who were in their local neighborhood, realized it made more sense for them to look after a couple friends' kids so the others could go out to work. Look, you know, childcare is extremely expensive in this country. So often childminders haven't really gone through the trainings that you might see from other early years practitioners. So having simple evidence-based tools that they can use is super valuable. So we actually would love to start working with childminders.
That's very interesting. So I know that BISA just commissioned a report on the landscape of early years childcare and education in the UK. So there's quite an interesting detailed analysis there of the split between nurseries, daycare centres, nurseries attached to primary schools and childminders. So I'll attach that to the show notes as well. It's quite interesting. And how are you feeling after last night's cocktails? Did you have any gossip or...
It was a really great night. I really enjoyed the opportunity to share what we're doing at Easy Peasy with such an amazing group of practitioners, startups, investors from the education community. There was a great momentum that's sort of been unleashed after last night, which I'll be working very hard to capitalize on over the next month or so.
Does that read sort of 200 emails in your inbox? Or
I did actually, because I just had a long team meeting this morning, and so I just peeked in at my inbox before coming in to speak with you, and it blew the hair back on my head.
Control-Alt-Delete is always really helpful with that.
But it's all good stuff, right? Like so many great connections last night, potential collaborations, potential investors, potential schools to work with. So, you know, great night.
And if people want to find out more about Easy Peasy, how do they do that?
Yeah, I would say head to our website. You can get there at easypeasyapp.com. And you can take a look at our content, the type of content that we share with parents. You can sign up for a free trial. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter. You can find Easy Peasy on Twitter and Facebook. We'll be looking out for you.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you very much for your time, and have a nice weekend.
Thank you very much.
quick message before we move on to the amazing open simulation case study. The good guys at EdTechX Europe have kindly offered you all as podcast listeners a 40% discount to attend EdTechX Europe on the 15th and 16th of June. So join the rising stars and the brightest minds of EdTech from across the globe on June the 15th and 16th at King's Place in London. This year, EdTechX Europe will bring together founders, CEOs, investors, innovators, educators, influencers, and startups to discuss the now and next of EdTech. If you want to register, visit edtechxeurope.com and access an exclusive podcast 40% discount. Please use the promo code ETE16EDTECHPD. That's ETE16EDTECHPD. And again, the website is edtechxeurope.com.
There are 5 billion people in the world today who don't have access to safe and affordable surgery. That means 2 out of every 3 of us. This is leading to the loss of 18 million lives every year, which is by far the biggest problem in the global healthcare today, according to the Global Commission for Surgery. To fix this problem, we need 2.2 additional surgical trainees, anesthetists, obstetricians, and gynecologists in next 15 years of time. But with existing methods of training, it would take 300 years to reach the target. Because surgical training hasn't changed since the Victorian times. Surgeons still learn by observing the surgery in a complex manner, which is quite crowded operating rooms. When they don't observe the surgery properly, they compensate the knowledge using textbooks and flat screens. Now, this is not right because there's a huge gap between what they actually learn and what they actually perform in an operating room. And that is
scary. I'm Yesh. I'm the co-founder of Open Simulation. I have a background in medical visualization.
My name's Edward Miller. I've been working in the field of virtual reality and augmented reality for the past 6 or so years. And I'm working on how we can actually track the position of surgical instruments using just computer vision.
Perfect. And how would you describe Open Simulation for those people who are not familiar with the platform yet?
So Open Simulation is creating a suite of low-cost simulation products to bring surgical training to people in the lower and income countries that need surgical training the most.
And then in terms of the access to that training, you mentioned that in your presentation. Can you give the actual scale of that problem as well?
Yes. Currently in countries like Bangladesh and India and even Nigeria, for every 10,000 people, there are less than one surgeon. So we need to drastically increase the surgical training and surgical workforce. To do that, surgical simulation is the key. But these countries cannot afford high-end surgical simulations, and that's where Open Simulation comes into picture, where we bring high-end surgical simulation at low cost, bringing surgical simulation to everyone and thereby improving the training.
When people are learning or training through Open Simulation, is there a tangible aspect to it? So for example, can they feel resistance and that kind of thing?
Sure. So what you're talking about is haptic okay. Or tactile feedback about what you're actually doing.
I'm glad you knew what I was talking about.
The most expensive or the most popular simulators that you'll find in UK hospitals, there's a brand called Symbionics, which is owned by the company 3D Systems. It's this behemoth that owns or created the very first 3D printer. Now, they have these laparoscopic simulators that use haptic feedback within their simulations. So if you actually move the surgical instrument towards tissue, you feel that force feedback. You can feel that through your hands. However, obviously, these kits, this is what we're trying to address, you know, cost upwards of £200,000. And actually, looking at efficacy studies of these Symbionics kits, we didn't ever see any conclusive evidence that the force feedback, the haptic feedback from these devices, actually led to a better training and a decrease in time it took to learn the skills. So all of the studies that were conducted to look into how haptics feedback improves surgical simulation and surgical training and acquisition of skills, they were inconclusive. So we said, right, okay, if it's inconclusive, how much of these kits can we strip back? What's the minimum that we can use to actually produce something that is at least comparable and produce something that a fraction of the cost while reaching the same level of skill acquisition?
And in terms of what that looks like, can you sort of describe, you know, I know you've gone through various iterations, and what's wonderful about what you're doing is that, you know, it's literally so resourceful. From, I can't remember what the first iteration used, but now it's a box bar, and then now it's developed further, but it's still very much about low resource intensity, I suppose, and getting that into people's hands.
Yeah, so we started with just a cardboard kit, like a pizza box. So from the pizza box, we moved to a box file, which is a stationary box file. And from the box file, we moved to the current wooden box. So basically, the idea which we want to share with the world is that you don't need high-end complex things with you. You just need your mobile phone and just a cardboard box, and you could learn how to perform a surgery. And that is something which hasn't been addressed till date, which we are addressing with this problem.
And are you working with the mobile phone operators or the handset operators to think about parts of the ecosystem that will need to be in place in terms to make this work, perhaps in more remote aspects as well of the countries that you're talking about?
So we're not working with any specific mobile operators at the moment. What we wanted with Open Simulation was to create a mobile application that would work on the majority of modern smartphones. And as long as we can address that, as long as we can make sure that it will actually work on people's phones in lower income countries, then we will have succeeded. And it seems that we've actually managed to do that. So I'll dig just a little bit into how we're achieving this. So on the end of these surgical graspers, these laparoscopic graspers that surgeons will use to perform keyhole surgeries, we've placed small cubes, we've actually 3D printed them, small cubes on the end of these graspers that contain a binary image, a little bit like a checker box image, that the mobile application will be able to track and recognize. So basically, we're able to detect where the ends of these surgical instruments are using the mobile application. And once we know where the ends of these surgical instruments are, we can then render a mobile simulation onto the top of the mobile phone.
In terms of your business model, is that very much something that you're looking to distribute sort of direct to those potential surgeons,
yes,
rather than going through hospitals or existing manufacturers such as
3D systems? Yes, our aim is to reach to the end user, who is medical students, surgical trainees, sometimes surgeons as well. Because all this while, these people who are the end users never got access to these simulations in their hand. And our aim is to reach them. But of course, we are interested in combining, collaborating with the universities and developing custom content for that particular module of that particular surgery. So we are looking from both top-down and bottom-up approach, moving from the universities to the students and also from the students to the universities. But for now, we are concentrating on the end user.
Okay, wonderful. How does open simulation differ to physical simulation resources already in use? So in a previous life, I was kind of aware of, you know, the sort of fake setups that you'd have and the models and that kind of thing. So what are kind of main benefits of this versus those kind of existing simulation activities?
Sure. So there are, I guess, what are commonly called lap boxes, where you'll have a box, you'll have a webcam that's connected to a computer so you can see what happens inside that box. You'll have a set of real surgical instruments, real surgical graspers and cutters. And inside that box, you'll have a selection of what we're calling analog tasks, so physical tasks. You'll be asked to stack cubes on one another, or you'll be asked to thread a piece of thread through a series of hoops. Now, with these tasks, you're limited to what's actually physically inside the box. And what's physically inside the box doesn't necessarily relate very well to what it actually looks like if you're performing an operation.
Yeah, and with virtual reality, what we could do is we could get any kind of surgical simulation on the mobile phone. So we are not limited to the physical analog tasks. Yes, those are the initial basic skills, but we can go up to the procedural skills as complex as gynecology procedures and appendectomy surgery.
Okay, and I know that I think there was a stat I read today, which was that there's been $4 billion US dollars worth of investment in VR since 2010 to 2015.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a lot of editorial around VR being hype and that kind of thing. So what's your answer to that, and, you know, and why this actually goes beyond the hype that's being talked about?
Sure. So at the moment, virtual reality is being very closely associated with head-mounted displays, actually. So displays like Oculus and HTC Vive, and even augmented reality headsets. You'll become aware of the name Magic Leap. over the next few years, I'm sure. But this is incorrect. So actually, virtual reality has been used in the operating theatre or in simulation suites for the past 20 years, actively. And this isn't head-mounted displays. These are simulators that simulate these operations virtually. Now, at the moment, you'll hear a lot of talk about how virtual reality is going to have a huge amount of impact on education as well as healthcare. But you should be very careful to kind of to listen to exactly how that will actually manifest. With healthcare, it's not just a question of technology, unlike in education, where virtual reality is obviously succeeding very well in. With healthcare, you have political red tape. You have to have efficacy trials to show that what you're doing is actually helping the end case. So it's not just the technology that's holding things back.
So like in the US, you have the FDA, and here you have NICE, and you have to approve.
Precisely so.
And also, I think as a part of my PhD, Edward and I are working on the same problem, as in we are trying to test how effective is a head-mounted display virtual reality in comparison with the existing methods of surgical training. That's my PhD. So,
okay, wonderful. So actually getting some proof points behind
yes,
that as well.
Yes, yeah.
Cool. So, and then what's next for Open Simulation? So obviously you had the pitch here. How do you think that went? And, you know, what's next in terms of, is it investment? Is it building the team?
So we are very glad from the point where we came and where we are right now. But it's just the beginning. So in the next 6 to 12 months, we are going to build the basic skills of laparoscopic surgery, reach out to the market, and also from today's meeting, we are going to follow up each and every investor who is interested in our product and the bigger idea, because this is not good. This is just beginning, and we have a lot in our minds to do.
And when did you actually sort of launch as Open Simulation?
We just launched 4 months back.
Wow. Okay.
Because Edward and I, we've got this idea in November. It's Edward's brainchild, and we worked on it in the first 2 months, and we launched in the December second week.
Wonderful. And if people want to find out more, where can they go for more information?
Please do go to opensimulation.org, or feel free to reach out to either Yesh or myself directly. I'm sure we can leave it with you to add in the show notes.
Perfect. Will do. So thanks very much, and enjoy the evening as well.
Thanks
a lot.
Thank
you.
Bye-bye.
That's all for this week. Thanks again to ClassList and EdTechX Europe. For those who enjoyed, please subscribe, rate and review on iTunes. And next week we will have Howdo and Crayana talking about life as an EdTech startup. See you then.